When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people who were listening, he entered Capernaum. There, a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was ill and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him, "This man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue." So Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, "Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, 'Go,' and he goes, and that one, 'Come,' and he comes. I say to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, "I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel." Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well.
Well, please keep that Bible passage open at that page. That would be really helpful to have it in front of you. Aidan, thank you very much for reading it for us. The title this morning is "When We Feel We Deserve Better," from Luke chapter 7, verses 1 to 10, page 1035. Do you ever feel that we are not getting all that we deserve in life? That life really could be kinder to us than it has been? Perhaps it's society that has let us down. Perhaps it's the people around us. There's a sense that the world owes us just a little more. It could be a health problem that really stays in your mind, an illness that causes pain or worry. Even a smaller health problem can become a big thing if it just won't go away and it goes on and it's a constant discomfort and inconvenience with no end in sight. Maybe the issues are financial, to do with our career or our home or our property. If we have some, we feel that we do have talents and we do work hard, and yet somehow that hasn't really been recognised. And we can't make ends meet, or others are paid more for doing less, perhaps. We feel it should have been better. Maybe we're struggling with something else. Could be any number of things, couldn't it? The reality of evil in this world and the way that it leaves us afraid. The problems in the natural world and the great harm that can do. Better relationships, feeling isolated. Somehow you've been dealt a difficult hand and you just can't see why it wasn't better. And that is why these chapters of Luke's Gospel that we're just starting this morning are so important and such wonderful good news for us. Because they are all about God rescuing. Rescuing people from all that is not good and not right in this world. Saving us for something that is so much better than that. Saving every kind of person in every possible way. Luke 8 and 9 have that as their theme. The writer Luke seems to have marked those chapters off as being something that sort of stands together with the way it's worded at the beginning and the end. And they have that theme, which is summed up right in the middle of those two chapters, in the words of Jesus, "Your faith has saved you." Chapter 7, last words in chapter 7. Your faith has saved you. That word "saved" is an important word, a massive word. A huge word. Luke uses that word a lot more in these chapters than Bible writers usually do, because he wants us to notice this is about being saved. You might not see that easily as you read it in our English translation. It was more obvious when Luke wrote it himself. So just for example, in our reading a moment ago in verse 3, it said, "Come and heal him." But actually what Luke wrote was, "Come and save him." Well, it's the same thing, isn't it, in a way? Come and save him from his sickness, from his illness, from death. Another way of saying that is, "Come and heal him." The translators haven't got it wrong, but Luke is really trying to say This is about being saved. Not just about being healed. It's about being saved in every sense. And that's why I think Luke is constantly trying to remind people of what was written earlier in the Bible, the time before Jesus, the Old Testament. I wonder if you noticed that our second reading from Luke was similar in some ways to our first reading from the Old Testament. That is deliberate on Luke's part. He does that a lot in these chapters. He wants us to realise that Jesus is the saviour that God's been promising for so long. And in the Old Testament, in those stories in the Old Testament, the people need saving because they've disobeyed God. They've sinned against him. And so they're under God's judgment, under God's suffering. They've rejected God, and that's why all of their experience of life is broken and difficult. And so when Jesus saves people from sin, from God's judgment against sin, from God's justice, when he saves people, he saves them not only from that, but from everything that is broken and wrong because of that judgment. That's what he's going to do when we meet him at the end of our lives. And he does that in advance in these stories, just to show that he can and that he will. So these chapters are full of pictures of that great salvation, showing us what Jesus can and will do. In story after story, Jesus saves people from sickness, from death, from bereavement, from grief, from fear and despair, from poverty, from isolation, from nature gone wrong, from evil that's out of control. And there's no kind of person that he can't save either. His salvation reaches so far to Gentiles, to non-Jewish people as well as to Jewish people, to women as well as men, to the poor as well as the rich, and above all, he saves sinners. It's all summed up by Jesus. Your faith has saved you. Well, we're just going to look this morning at the first of those pictures, those windows on the great good news of salvation. And it really helps us with that idea of faith. What would that look like? What is that faith? Luke is raising the issue of being worthy of salvation. That's the first theme I'm going to put up on the screen from chapter 7, verses 1 to 6, being worthy of salvation. You see, most people think that what matters, if you're going to get the best out of life, what matters is to be worthy, to be deserving. And we'll see that that's completely wrong. But Jesus doesn't look at it that way at all. But that's how most people do look at it. So chapter 7 begins with that idea. Let me read it again from page 1035, chapter 7. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people who were listening, he entered Capernaum. There, a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was ill and about to die. The centurion heard of this and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. Now here is someone who seems worthy. He's really done well in life. You've got to admire him. He's impressive. He's risen to a very high rank. He is a great military leader in the greatest military superpower of the time in the Roman Empire. His job title is centurion. Probably that seems to mean he has at least 100 people, 100 soldiers. That's why he's called a centurion, I would guess. And yet he does value his one servant. Now that's something, isn't it? A lot of powerful people at the top don't really care all that much about the people at the bottom. This guy's not like that. He values his servant very highly. You know, the guy who, I don't know, cleans his boots maybe, or does his gardening for him, or whatever it is. He values him, he treasures him highly. And the servant is sick. He is so badly unwell, the doctors say, look, he hasn't got long to live, and there's nothing more we can do for him. But there is one more thing that could be done for him, because his boss, the centurion, has heard about Jesus. That's not surprising. Jesus has been doing incredible, amazing things. He must have been very famous in a short time. People have heard that if there is one person who can rescue this guy as he dies, well, surely it is Jesus. Everyone's talking about Jesus. So the centurion sends messengers. Now, did you notice who the messengers were? They are the Jewish elders in verse 3. The elders of the Jews are the most important people, the leaders of the town and the leaders of that faith. And he manages to get them to go and take a message to Jesus. So he couldn't really have got better referees, better people to vouch for him than these elders. He comes very highly commended. And here's what they say to Jesus in verse 4. The elders of the Jews, they find Jesus. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. This man deserves to have you do this. He deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. So Jesus went with them. This is why they think he should be helped. He's deserving. He's even shown, even though he's not Jewish, even though he's Roman, he's from the enemy army, he has shown that he actually really cares about the people of God and their nation and their community so much so he's even built a place of worship for them. I guess he paid for it out of his own pocket perhaps, or authorized it and got his men working on it. So he's shown that he's a good guy. He's worthy. He's deserving. Verse 4, this man deserves to have you do this. Now, still today, when we approach Jesus, when we come to Jesus, very often we come thinking that we need to be worthy, that we need to be deserving. And some of us don't find it at all difficult to think that we might be deserving, and we think we've done well in life, and we're quite happy with approaching, waiting for Jesus to say, well done, you've done a great job, quite like him to congratulate us. Others maybe feel a bit discouraged by that thought, because we don't really feel that we've been very deserving or worthy, and we wonder whether there's any point in coming to Jesus. But both approaches are completely wrong. We don't come to Jesus saying that we are worthy. It's understandable that people jump to that conclusion and make that assumption, because that's how most things in life work. There's an American poet, there's a picture of him called Longfellow, who wrote those words on the screen. The heights by great men reached and kept were not attained by sudden flight, but they, while their companions slept, were toiling upward in the night. That's how we think it works in life. You work really hard to get your way up the ladder. You show that you've got the talent or the skill or the hard work or the dedication. You get your qualifications, your education, you get your job, you get your promotion, you get paid as a reward for what you do. And it's all about being worthy and being deserving. And religion is all about that. The five pillars of Islam tell you what to do to get to the paradise of Jannah. You have to pray and fast and give and go on a pilgrimage and submit to Allah. Buddhism teaches the eightfold path to enlightenment or nirvana. Eight things you do to deserve that. It's to do with right effort and right speech and right conduct and right mindfulness, and that's just four of the eight. Hinduism says if you do good in this life, you will be reincarnated into a better life. It's the principle of karma. It's really the same, isn't it? Every religion says the same. Be worthy. Be deserving. Earn it. Achieve it. And all too often, people come to Christianity in the same way. And we even have churches that teach that as if it were Christianity. And all too often, we just slip into that way of thinking, perhaps without even noticing that we have. That we need to be worthy and deserving of the help of Jesus. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. That's the issue that's raised then at the start, being worthy of salvation. But then we find out that being worthy of salvation is knowing we are not worthy. That's verses 6-8. The only way to be saved is to realize that we need to be saved. The only way to really receive that salvation is to say to ourselves, look, I'm not worthy. And not deserving and not good enough, and to face up to that. So chapter 7, verse 6, let me read on from there. So Jesus went with them, verse 6. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. See what he says there? I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. It's the opposite of what the Jewish leaders just said about him. They said in verse 4, this man is deserving. He says in verse 6, I do not deserve to have you come. See, Jesus is just on his way to the house. He's getting quite close now. Perhaps he's just around the corner. The centurion hears that Jesus has made this special trip to come to his house. And he's a bit embarrassed about that. There must be some misunderstanding. Quickly, send some more messengers, send some friends to go and tell Jesus, really, you don't need to go to all that trouble just for little me. I didn't expect you to be changing your plans and making a special visit to come to my house. I mean, it's embarrassing, isn't it, that Jesus might think the centurion is sitting there at home thinking, I'm too important to bother to come to Jesus. He has to come to me. No, that wasn't it at all. That isn't what the centurion was thinking. He was thinking, I can't go to Jesus because I don't deserve to be heard by him. I'm not worthy enough to appear before Jesus and ask him. That's why I'm not coming in person. That's why I sent the Jewish elders instead. He's keen to say that he's not worthy. And you can actually see from the very first word in his message, you can see something important in verse 6. Really important word. The first word that he uses in this message that he's passing on to Jesus is the word Lord. Lord. Jesus is Lord in this situation. Jesus is the most important person here, far above this centurion. I think we already are getting the idea this is the man who is used to having people serve him. He's got his servant who's ill. He's a centurion. He's got 100 soldiers. He's sent the Jewish elders to take one message. He's sent his friends to take another message. He's very used to having people do what he says. But Jesus is not that. He's not just another person to do as he's told by the centurion. Jesus is Lord. And before Jesus, the centurion knows that he's nothing and he's nobody. And he's not worthy and he's not deserving. Chapter 7, verse 7. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. I didn't even think I was worth appearing before you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. It's not as if Jesus really needs to make a special trip and come all the way to the house and see the servant in order to heal him. Jesus just has to say the word wherever he is. Of course it will happen, because Jesus is Lord. Verse 8, for I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one go and he goes, and that one come and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. See, this guy is a guy who knows that Jesus has authority. He knows how authority works. He's used to being in the military. He knows what it looks like to give an order. You don't make suggestions in the military. You don't have a discussion and reach a consensus. You don't ask everyone what their opinion is and what they think that should be done next. You receive orders, you give orders. He tells someone to jump, and they say, how high? He says to someone, what kind of sycophant are you? And they say to him, well, what kind of sycophant would you like me to be? He is used to being in charge and having the power. And he knows that Jesus has that power, not just over 100 men in one town, over the whole universe, over sickness, over death, to give orders. Captain D.L. Martin served in the First World War. He was a maths teacher from Devon. He carefully worked out from models and drawings that he and his men would be killed on the 1st of July. But an order is an order. So he led them out anyway and they were killed on the 1st of July. That's how it works in the military. You do as you're told. And that's how it works in this universe. Things happen as Jesus commands them. How much more so for Jesus? He is creator of the universe. Everything that is in this world is there because God gave the word. And Jesus is that word. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Everything answers to Jesus. Every problem, every sickness, every danger, every difficulty. And so he isn't at our beck and call. I wonder, when we pray, do we sometimes talk to him as if he were sort of a waiter and we were at a restaurant and we were asking him to bring what we've asked and we're a little bit frustrated that it hasn't come on time? I was in a restaurant the other day and trying to get a waiter's attention. And if I'm honest, I was feeling slightly more frustrated than I really should have done. It's only a tiny thing, you know. We weren't in a hurry, but somehow it bothered me that this guy wasn't there to wait on my every command, just when I wanted him to be. And are we like that with Jesus in our heart of hearts? As if he owes us something. As if the universe should have given us something better. We have this culture, I guess, of entitlement. We use the language of human rights. Sometimes Christians suggest maybe we should be talking about human responsibilities rather than human rights. because everything that God gives us in life is a generous and free gift. We've been given far, far more than we deserve. And in fact, the response that we usually give God in return is disobedience and rebellion and frustration and sinfulness. Jesus doesn't answer to us. We answer to him. So being worthy of salvation then is knowing we are not worthy. And not only that, it's knowing that we are not worthy and trusting the one who is. That's verses 9 and 10. Trusting Jesus, the one who is worthy, who is deserving of our faith and our trust. You see, instead of trusting ourselves and saying, well, I deserve it, I'm worthy, or I'm not worthy, I don't deserve it. Instead of trusting myself, the important thing is to put my faith and trust in Jesus. So chapter 7, verse 9. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel. Jesus turns around to all of his followers and said, look, here's someone you can learn from. I've not seen such great faith. Not even from the people who really ought to have that faith. The people of Israel, the people who've known the Bible all their lives and been taught it and grown up with it. You know, the Jewish elders, they're the ones who came to Jesus and said, look, this guy deserves to be saved. Have they not read the Bible? Last term we looked at the Old Testament law, Deuteronomy. It was all about God giving us what we don't deserve and being generous and how we've turned against him, and yet he forgives us and loves us and saves us. But it's almost as if they hadn't read it or they'd forgotten it. They turned it into what they thought it should say. Even in Israel, Jesus says, I've not found such great faith. You wouldn't expect it from the leader of the Roman occupying force. But he understands that he's not worthy. And he understands that Jesus is Lord. That is great faith. That is the faith that saves. The faith that saves. And so in verse 10, then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. He's already better before they even get there. As the centurion said, Jesus just says the word. Doesn't even need to come to the house, doesn't need to meet the person, just say the word because Jesus has that power. You see, the centurion was right. Sickness and death answer to Jesus. And to be saved, all it takes is a word from him. Now that is great faith. Now please, we need to be careful, I think, about this word faith, because a lot of the time we will hear that word faith used to mean something totally different from what Jesus says here. A lot of people think faith is a bit like the Alice in Wonderland story, where one of the characters says, well, sometimes I believe in 6 impossible things before breakfast. As if faith is about believing impossible things and forgetting your knowledge of facts and history and science and forgetting all of that. A bit like on Peter Pan, you know, where children have to say they don't believe in fairies, but they have to convince themselves somehow that they do. I do believe in fairies, and then suddenly a fairy does exist. That's not faith. That's not what Jesus means by faith. That's superstition. It's a little daft. It's a little unwise to go through life like that. Might even be a symptom of a kind of fairly serious mental health problem, but it's certainly not faith to think that way. The atheist writer Richard Dawkins says this. He says, faith is blind trust in the absence of, even in the teeth of, evidence. Well, that's not how Jesus uses the word faith. He never means that. And that is why he does this miracle. That is why he is showing the centurion and all his followers that it is true that he can simply say the word and it will happen. And that is why Luke writes his whole account. He starts off Luke's gospel at the very beginning by saying why he is writing. He said, I'm writing to make believers more certain of what they've been taught. Luke says, look, I've gone to the eyewitnesses. I've got it from the sources. I've collected together a lot of evidence. And here it is. In Luke, well, this is only one story, but Luke is full of much more than that. The Bible gives us, as a whole, gives us many, many reasons to believe. Faith is not about believing without reason or believing without evidence. It's about trusting that reason and trusting that evidence. And particularly, it's about putting our trust in Jesus and not in ourselves. So how's your faith getting on? How's it going? Question I've been asking myself as well. Is that a symptom maybe that faith is in, it's not going so well when we feel that resentment, that frustration that life really should have dealt us a better hand, as if we deserve it, as if Jesus is taking too long bringing what we ordered. What a wonderful thing. We don't want to be like the Jewish people in this story who know their Bibles well, but just have slipped into assuming that we somehow it's about being worthy or being deserving. We can never do that. But the wonderful good news is that Jesus saves, that the word saves, you know, he rescues us from all. I mean, we won't put it right all straight away, but by putting our faith in him, we know that Jesus can and will in the end deal with every difficulty and every problem and give us far, far more than we could ever have deserved. And he begins that in this life, he finishes it in the next life. So will we say to Jesus, I'm not worthy, I don't deserve, but you are Lord. Just say the word, and it will be so.